Next case is 97-1502, Kathleen Freshwater versus Robert Scheif.
Respect, we've read the briefs, we understand the facts, we get to the law, and my first question of you is that the propositions of law number one and two that you propose, would they be a narrower application of the learned treatise doctrine than the federal rule?
Yes, they would.
You seem to be limited to it just really to this case, that is, because there might be cases where a physician would want to cross-examine a physician on the learned treatise doctrine, where he had not written a book and had used part of it. Okay, and with regard to the first proposition of law, may not have had those materials in his training where he's gotten the certificate. Is that right?
That is very true.
Okay, but you.
The case came up, the Stenson case was the most recent precedent, Rule 766 passed. I think that the amicus brief covers a broader scope than I did on ways to go about what a proper rule would be. He indicates that if there's an indicia of reliability or indicia of authoritativeness, then the materials ought to be allowed to be cross-examined. Footnotes also to the Stenson case give kind of a review of what other states are doing. 20 have accepted the federal rule, and they have some other different ones. And one court in particular dealt specifically with medical negligence and standard of care as to those issues, and has special rules of cross-examining the human.
In your handling of this case and your research, did you develop any reason why Ohio did not adopt the federal rule like we have most of the other rules?
I think it goes back to the original Ohio's thinking on hearsay in general, and that if somebody federal law says, yeah, we'll let in hearsay if it's good hearsay, and Ohio wants to see the person actually in the courtroom and be able to cross-examine them. They were very tight on those issues in the early 1970s when the evidence rule came up and held to that.
Well, but of course we did adopt a lot of exceptions to the hearsay rule.
Sure, but the federal has a catch-all exception.
21.
Say good, let it in. And I think that Ohio's thinking on that was similar I was a trial counsel and attempted to cross-examine both the defense expert and the defendant doctor in the case. And the word authoritative was almost like the word open sesame, because the doctor would never say it, and I could never get the court to open sesame into these parts. When trying to talk to Dr. Zucker, I'm asking him authority. He said, I'm not sure what the authority is, the one I would use. But he, a doctor, it's given to his personal friend. My friend played with his kids. He's a respected colleague. I often spoke him. He's a very honorable and honest individual with very good experience and value his opinion. And you value his opinion, yes. That wasn't enough. I pursued him 6 days later on authority. He says, I'm not sure about the word authoritative, but I value his opinion and expertise. It wasn't enough for the trial court cross-examining him with Dr. Fitzgibbon's article. What's interesting about the article is Dr. Zucker wrote a book called Surgical Laparoscopy. The preface to the book says that the purpose of the book is, quote, intended to serve as a comprehensive and practical reference for surgeons learning these techniques and sharing their experience to emphasize ways to avoid complications that can occur with any new procedure. That's what he indicates outside the courtroom, that his book is authoritative, and he doesn't limit it to chapters. So we get into the courtroom, he publishes this book, other doctors are read, it's meant for the other doctors to read, and how to go about this new procedure. He invites Dr. Fitzgibbons to write the procedure that we're dealing with in this particular case, open laparoscopic procedure, where you take a little look into the abdomen before you take a sharp trocar and then figure out what you did or what you didn't get.
Wasn't the testimony, quote unquote, or the treatise that you wanted to give it didn't really talk about what the standard was, it just talked about another way of doing things.
There, you will not. I would say yes and no. I would say that you and I do a lot of research on this. I work real hard to try to set these processes. I don't come across articles that say this is the standard of care.
And isn't that one of the very basic problems with learned treating? Is that you don't have a doctor on the stand saying the standard of care. You don't have an opportunity to test those alternative theories, to test the basis behind. You don't have a live witness that you can cross-examine. You claim you want to cross-examine this guy, but by doing the learned treating method, you deprive the other side of the ability to cross-examine.
Well, let me finish in full context, is that there might be a medical article somewhere on a case that I've tried on medical negligence that says this is what the standard of care is. The medical association won't say it because they'll get crucified. Sages did stuff on here of what you ought to know, what a doctor ought to be trained in. They will tell you the risk factors, and they were in these articles, of the risk factors of going in blindly versus the risk factors of going in openly. There's articles that we proffered that said that if you go in blindly, you can cause an injury to a small bowel or a bowel that is unique to going in blindly. It can give you the statistics and the training materials of Dr. Scheidt that bowel injuries, more than half of them are caused by blind trocar insertions, and that's why you want to go to open laparoscopy. And when you add those things together, you will not get a doctor to say this is the standard of care, but you will be able to come and fit the pieces together as to why the standard of care is not to blindly go in with the trocar.
Let's say that the physician who authored or who did not book, he published a book that different people contributed to. Let's say three of the chapters were on, new technique, cutting edge technique. Simply because he was a publisher of it and invited some controversial opinions in, does that now make it authoritative so that he would have to accept those positions even though he doesn't necessarily agree with it? I just put it in there so that my readership would have other ideas to look at and fresh cutting edge stuff.
First of all, I'm going to answer that's not this case because Dr.
Have to write a law. We have to write a law that fits all cases, and if it's a principle that you're espousing, that because he was the publisher, it automatically makes it authoritative for purposes of the
No, I understand that the first time a heart transplant comes down when somebody has an illness, that that's not the standard of care. And it will take years to tell what the standard of care is for a particular medical procedure, because it has to get to a broad enough group of doctors. So the cutting edge is an accurate statement. But the harm of this is we have doctors who you can put almost a gun to their head and they will not say the word authority, and you will get no medical treatment and you will have no effect of cross-examination when they're representing what the standard of care is for the medical community, and I can't even get Dr. Zucker to get a representation of what the medical community is within his own book. And he values that guy's opinion, and he read that chapter in the book, and he relied on part of that chapter in the book, but omitted other parts. And the medical articles aren't biased like that. They're not up there for a particular purpose other than to educate doctors. And the doctor who is cross-examined with medical articles certainly can explain the context of that article, why that article is out of place, how it doesn't fit in the context. Doctors are very, very good at explaining those things, and that's in their field. But to not allow anything as the standard of care with medical literature that one doctor was trained on, that he put his certificates into evidence.
Yeah, but I go to a lot of seminars where I'm, quote, trained, and I don't agree with what the person sitting up there is telling me. And just because I went to the seminar doesn't mean I accept or buy what's being espoused.
So that
doesn't sound like a very sound standard to me. You went to the seminar, therefore, whatever was taught in that seminar, I can talk to them if you want. Now I'm learning to read it.
Dr. Scheider was not credentialed in this procedure. Dr. Scheider, between 1990 and 1992, went to coursework to become credentialed so that he could get permission from the other defendant doctor to do this procedure. He submitted some of these items to the hospital to prove that he was qualified for this procedure. In his own examination, he went through those seminars and said, why you should believe me, why I'm a credible guy. He put the certificates into evidence, including one guy who couldn't even remember, Dr. Paul Kane, and said, believe me, I'm credible. I know what I'm talking about in laparoscopy. I have these ribbons and these certificates that he really participated, not satisfactorily passed those courses. And that was the basis for him being able to testify as an expert, being able to give an opinion on standard of care, being able to do the surgery at all. He can do all this stuff to increase his credibility, but we want to look behind these certificates. We want to look at what his training really told him and what the risk factors are of blindly going in versus something and how often you get valves compared to other times when you don't get valves. All of that now is on
broad enough to cover.
So I understand an esoteric type of situation where you go to a seminar and you may not know everything, but if I go to a seminar on uninsured motorists and I'm told, whatever you do, don't sign a release in this case, whatever you do, don't sign a release in this case, whatever you do, don't sign a release in this case, and I go home and I sign a release in that case, it's fair game that I've been told two or three times that I can never sign a release in that case, and I may be taken. The medical field is even more than that. He increased his credibility testifying this. He gained his right to testify from these courses, and he gained his right to do surgery from these courses. And he's allowed to give an opinion of what the whole community and what the standard medical care is, and I'm not, based on his education, this procedure was from 1990 to 1992, as to laparoscopic procedure of blowing up the abdomen.
But you can do all that through your own expertise, you can challenge all those issues, you can that same one treated, you can do all that through your own expertise.
And then the jury's sitting there and says, oh, you guys have a certificate to say this, you guys have a certificate to say that, and you know, they didn't cross-examine him with any medical articles, they didn't cross-examine him with medical articles. This guy says he's the authority, he doesn't recognize any authority. He says he's the authority, doesn't recognize any authority. This guy says he's the authority, doesn't recognize any authority. What should I do?
Putting aside the authoritative language in the case law and in your argument, is it also so that, or is it your argument that he actually relied on these treatises?
Dr. Zucker relied on the treatises specifically before court for his testimony, and it's my position that Dr. Scheidt relied on his education to
be an expert, and therefore, yeah, I understand.
His education for these courses.
If that's the case, would that not fit you, if we found that, would that not fit you in Stinson?
Not under a conservative interpretation, but under a broader interpretation.
Explain that to me. Because it specifically says,
I think it's real clear.
Who has relied upon the treatise, or it's in the disjunctive.
Okay. I asked Dr. Scheidt about whether he relied, and said, oh, I can't remember one of these from another one of these, you know, which doctor said what. But he was allowed to say, so he couldn't nail him down as to one particular truth. And so he avoids that. Or they'll say, I rely upon my general knowledge of medicine. The judge was, and everybody's waiting for the word authoritative to come out. It was almost like, it all depends on what the definition of it is. You know, it was almost a root formal saying. So I think the reliance outside the courtroom is not really being taken by the courts or authorities outside the courtroom. They want the person to say, in the courtroom I rely upon this article, or in the courtroom I rely upon this, or in the courtroom this is in the courtroom.
Are you asking that Stinson be modified, and if so, how?
I'm asking that Stinson be broadened, or that I think there's a few ways you can do it. Stinson should be modified. I think the second proposition of law, I think, is close to it. I think we brought the definition of what reliance is. Reliance is in getting your education, or goes into the education you got in order to testify. I think that proposition number two makes a lot of sense. It says, as an expert medical witness, medical negligence case may not avoid cross-examination of the learned treatise by denying the authoritative nature of the treatise or author when the materials were taken from the expert's own published book. The learned treatise, which was partially relied upon by the expert testifying, and where it's apparent that the expert values and opinions are wrong. I'd say that if there's proof outside the courtroom that the person sees the person as an authority, then it ought to be included. And if the person has relied on that person in or out of the courtroom for his general opinions in the area or had written inside of the person, I think that those people are included. But I also think the new Rule 706 results are on the record.
Thank you, Mr. O'Neill. Mr. Willie.
The evidence in the record before the court demonstrates that the plaintiffs were committed a full and proper cross-examination of both Dr. Scheidt and his expert Dr. Zucker. The trial court properly interpreted and applied the law of this court to the facts in this case, did not abuse its discretion, and even if the use of these materials had been permitted, it would not have made any difference. The proper materials, all of these statements that plaintiffs claimed they needed to use from the proper materials were asked of Dr. Scheidt, and essentially he agreed with all of the statements admitted that there was no surgical additional purpose to use the statements directly from the materials. Certainly would not have changed the outcome of the case. With regard to Dr. Scheidt's training materials,
How do we know it would not have changed the outcome of the case?
Well, I think when you look at what questions were asked of Dr. Scheidt, he was called as first witness, and he was cross-examined to begin the trial. He was asked extensively questions that came directly from his proper materials. And Dr. Scheidt essentially agreed with all of those statements, all those opinions that were presented to him. So I don't see how having read to the jury again Well, and I should say that also I have to Dr. Shea to testify in direct. He was cross-examined again extensively. Not only the statements from the witness treatise, but from the deposition testimony, where he would ask verbatim the statements in the proper materials. And he again conceded the substance of the statement, such as there's an increased risk of bowel injury with a closed technique in a patient with cardiac surgeries. He agreed that use of the open technique reduces the risk of damage caused by a blinded surgeon with a needle or a trocar. He admitted that he was told how to do the open method in his training courses. This is a quote at page 109. So you don't stick a needle into an area where there may be adhesions, bowel suction, peritoneum.
Those are direct facts, though. When you get to the learned treatise doctrine, we're really talking about another theory of law, aren't we?
Yes.
Okay.
Right.
Let me ask you.
I'm saying in this case.
Yeah, I understand. You're saying that evidence was already in, and we've read that. Is it fair to say, as we have been seeing in some of our motions for cert, that this issue is now boiling down to the avoidance at all costs of ever using the word authoritative?
I think that conclusion may well be supported by many of the reported cases. Certainly, Rule 706, I think, cures that, and that was the point of 706, to eliminate that possibility. Now, any party has the opportunity to examine something as learned treatise, authentic material, by its own expert witness, if not by the witness on the stand, or through judicial notice.
But why is it significant that it was put in 706 as opposed to 803?
I do not believe so. I believe that the intent was to deal with the situation, remedy the situation, and the comment to 706 there was to...
But apparently 706 hasn't done it, because consistently, I think, we see that where a medical expert, regardless of which side they're on, adroitly or directly avoid the use of the word authoritative, trial courts are saying, can't cross-examine.
But now the remedy is, if you can't get around it that way, to have your own expert testify that these materials are authoritative. That was not done in this case. The problem was not made by Helen's own expert that any of these materials were so substantially reliable that they should be determined to be authoritative. So I do believe that the new rule does resolve and remedy the issues that have been brought to this.
When was 706 promulgated?
It went into effect in July 1988.
1998. When was this case tried?
The case was tried before that. I'm not sure they say.
It was tried before the new rule went into effect.
Yes, it was.
That's my point. And we haven't seen enough yet under the new rule to determine whether or not that is correcting the problem that is obviously perceived, or 706 wouldn't have been promulgated.
Well,
we do really, counselors, see a lot of this authoritative stuff, and it's pretty clear that if the word isn't used and it is avoided at all costs, I've found in a number of the motions for cert that I see that the trial courts feel like they're bound by that section in Stinson that says that you got to say authoritative.
Well, I believe that is law, certainly at the time this case was tried. There has to be a foundation made to use the materials for cross-examination purposes, and the foundation had to be either that the expert relied upon it or believed the materials were authoritative. That was not done in this case. That foundation was not made.
Is there some reason we should not, as a state, adopt the federal counterpart? A lot of states have gone to that now, and I'm not sure why we avoided it at the start, but I have some ideas, but I
think that still the advantage permitting any exception to learned treatise is simply for impeachment, cross-examination of a witness. The federal rule, of course, prevents use of the statement for direct evidence for the truth of the matter. the perceived problem in Ohio has been the supposed inability to cross-examine an expert witness who is testified on a matter if there are materials that contrary to his opinion. And Rule 706 certainly adequately resolves that problem and does permit a full impeachment cross-examination of an expert witness.
Why should we not equate such words as value one's opinion or consider one for his expertise as being equivalent to authoritative? Are we not, as Judge Bryant's concurring opinion emphasizes, points out, that this is a semantical problem, and I understand we lawyers work with words all the time, but why aren't words such as expertise and value of one's opinion equivalent to authoritative material?
Well, I think the issue actually goes beyond the semantics of what the witness says. It really, what the court wants to determine is that the material sought to use is so reliable in nature that it should be used. And I don't know that any, unless you use the word authoritative as this is the recognized authority on this issue. This is who you always turn to answer a question. That reliability is not established. We need to have some standard to establish the reliability of the material sought to be used. And that is the purpose of the rule. In this particular case, again, I urge the court to look at the evidence, what was actually committed for cross-examination of the witnesses. Dr. Shai truly admitted all the statements contained in the materials that were proffered in the court. It could not have affected the outcome in the case. And as far as Dr. Zucker, again, no foundation was laid to use the chapters by Dr. Fitzgibbons to cross-examine him. All the materials have different, they talk about the merits of the different options of the closed and the open technique.
In your view, could there be two treatises that that make contrary conclusions on a medical procedure that could be considered authoritative? Does there have to be one procedure that is deemed and one that's deemed authoritative to make the text authoritative?
Well, I think there again, what the purpose is to look for is something reliable, and I think the point is well made. If you look at the Hassan article, which was proper in this case, he weighs the risk, the relative risk and benefits of the different procedures, open and closed, and he noted that even with the open, which plaintiff's claim should have been used, there was a risk of laceration now and a significant risk of infection. So, that those data, those conclusions, I suppose, could have been stated in separate articles. Hassan noted how difficult it was to compare the data to determine whether the open or the closed was a better procedure. Infer from that that there could well be another study that had an opposite conclusion. That, I guess, would go to the credibility of how the study was done. All those issues would have to be established, but they're all collateral issues in order to ensure they have to get into it. So I guess that's the best way I can answer that, I suppose it could be. Certainly, none of the articles proper established the standard of care to be used in this case, that they weigh the risks and benefits of the different procedures. But nowhere does it say to use the closed procedure of patients prior to surgery is substandard or not permitted. Dr. Shai had been trained to use laparoscopic procedures for many years before he did his little gallbladder to that knowledge. He testified that he had done like 1,000 laparoscopic procedures before he did his first orders. During all the procedures, he would have used the closed abdominal entry method. And that is what he testified that he was familiar with, that's what he used. And again, I believe that court with the top down to remove all the letters that were stamped that much. Dr. Zucker did not testify in court that he did something differently than what he does outside of the courtroom. That he testified that he prefers to use the Hassan technique, which he uses in at least 90% of his cases where there's been prior surgery. So I do not think that there's anything inconsistent in the testimony of either Dr. Seigels or Dr. Zucker, which would have been contradicted by use of the inverted previous material proffered by the
appellant. Counsel, how should we deal with this stuff? I mean, I'm looking here at the exact questions and answers. Zucker's asked,
how many times the guy is going to say it's irritated. You want the guy to write this book?
What is that?
Since you have good friends? Yeah, I cite him. But I'm not saying it's right. I didn't use the words right.
Sidecar, excursion.
We have to have a clear extension.
So, the question comes back to the values. And you put out the book.
It's so deceptive.
The Rosen chapter is another doctor who is one that is
stressed. We have that in this. We are deceptive.
The book doctor said sentence because you
believe it's going to be a more extensive.
As I said, I'm not sure I would take it for the thought. Now, he's
terrible.
He's clearly been coached to avoid that term. So, how do we assist getting that truth?
Right.
Is everything is just off limits in terms of cross contamination?
No, I don't believe so. I think that the foundations of their consistent are appropriate, and I think that the Rule 706 now, by permitting our own expert to identify reliable material, resolves that issue. And, you know, in this case, with regard to Dr. Fitzgibbon's article, as well as by the court at Homer, he was an editor of that book. He had not expected to vouch for the statements contained in every article contained in every book. I don't think that's appropriate under the Homer doctrine. And again, in this particular case, Dr. Zucker did not make any statements which were contradictory to anything contained in either this given article or in the chapter in this book. So I think that the record demonstrates that substantial justice has been done to the appellant in this case.
Thank you, Mr. Willie. Mr. McGuire.
Slightly different point of the case, which we believe does not rise to quality materials in question, even assuming argumento, that they were authoritative or were relied upon. And that's because these materials at best are cumulative to the evidence already adduced in the case, and therefore were properly excluded by the trial judge in his discretion. They were cumulative because, frankly, the brilliant handling of this case by appellant's counsel. They got Dr. Scheidt to admit that it was a safer method, that he did not inform his patient of that safer method. He got Dr. Scheidt's expert to admit that his operative report, standing alone and before it was later modified, was evidence of malpractice. He got his own expert witness to say that Dr. Scheidt's choice of procedure was malpractice, and further that the very way he performed the procedure chosen was malpractice also, and violated the standard of care. All of this, we submit, went far beyond these materials, which, as Justice Stratton points out, do not touch on the standard of care. We believe there was ample evidence for the jury to find liability. It chose not to do so, and within the meaning of the Hallworth case, it is up to the appellant in this case to show that these materials changed the jury verdict. We believe the purpose of these materials at this point is to improperly argue with witnesses, or to offer these materials for the truth of the matters stated therein. Indeed, if we get into these materials, we will find that there are tidbits on both sides, allowing both sides to offer sentences to the various witnesses back and forth, and I submit creating confusion in the minds of the jury, mandated exclusion under Rule 403. And for these reasons, as I have stated, we believe the appeal was improperly granted. The issues raised before I got up here to argue need not be met, that the appeal was improperly granted, and it should be dismissed.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. McGuire. Mr. O'Neill, you've used your time. Can you take 30 seconds?
Officer Scheidt in the case, page 396, but there's no evidence of any cue ringers occur in the open technique when you look at them and put your finger in and look around because of that after a throw card is gone. He also indicated at page 407 that it's impossible to have an injury with a valve with a throw card. He talked at page 416 of the insertion of the varicine and the blind insertion of the throw card, but within general accepted standards. His massively adhered valves in the abdomen were just finally entered and was not required to convert to an open laparotomy. Problems he encountered were acceptable risk of surgical procedures. Materials don't indicate that. I indicated both judges clearly and on pages 543, 545, 546, 73, 74, I was putting these materials into cross examination, not for the purpose of matter asserted, limiting instructions for the purpose of the would have solved any problem for the individual purposes that is going to cross examine the doctors for the credibility because what they were representing was the standard of care in the courtroom was not the same as what they were dealing with.
In the current opinion, the Court of Appeals, two judges appear to agree with you that you should have been able to get into the treats, but they conclude that it doesn't affect you or shouldn't, and that failure to allow you to do that shouldn't affect the outcome.
Because they thought I was going for the truth of an adversary. And I have a site here on page 543. I said, Mr. I'm trying to get it in, and I'm talking to the judge. Correct, it's authoritative source. And that's why I kept using the word authority to try to lay the foundation. Because if I love what we're doing, he values his opinion. He doesn't have to agree with his opinion, otherwise, nobody would ever use it. I think he recognizes him as an authority. And if so, I can impeach him with that authority on the issue of impeachment, not on the issue of the truth of the matter, but as an authority that he recognizes as something different. And Judge Webb, the next page, understood what I was trying to do. The court's talking to me. So what you're wanting to do, Joe, as I take it, is if he acknowledges that this man is an authority, and if in fact in the opinion that he the man has expressed is inconsistent or at variance with Dr. Zucker's testifying, then you intend to use that to impeach me, correct? That's exactly what they're going to do. The issue is then a limiting instruction. If it wasn't trying, I even told in both cases I was not going to put the articles in as substance per se. I identified them. I think I over-proffered. I proffered so much that this wasn't a collateral issue to this trial that everybody thought I was trying to get the stuff in as a truth of the matter asserted. But the argument goes, if this Dr. Zucker is publishing books and having authors outside the courtroom and tells these people to look at this author and the risk factors are so much less outside the courtroom, can you believe him in the courtroom when he said that this is a standard of care and he's going to insert it? Can you believe that? And that's what
thank you, Mr. O'Neill. The case is submitted. We'll take a brief recess.
All rise.